welcome to Dialect. I'm Annabelle Provençal. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Martin Cosgrave, co-founder of Dialect. Martin sadly died in Malaga, Spain, 2 weeks ago. His funeral is taking place in London today, with his brother, Pat Cosgrave, reading tributes from Martin's friends, and Martin's friends from around the world. We have some more of Martin's music from 2002. Then, the truth behind the Bear Pit eviction. Two homeless people evicted last Wednesday because the Bear Pit was being used by spice dealers. We talk to Bear Pit residents, John and Martin. Finally, Tony Gosling praising another dissident book, The Last Great Secrets of World War II, as part of the Save Redland Library campaign. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at Dialect Radio, oneword.co.uk, and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen and paper ready at the end of the show.
For me, So I'm joined by Martin and John from the Bear Pit.
To make it crystal clear, this interview was recorded just before Martin and John were evicted on Wednesday the 19th of June 2019 by Bristol City Council.
First of all, John, you are actually living there at the moment, but whereabouts are you from originally? How did you end up living in the Bear Pit?
I'm from Hungary, and I end up living in the Bear Pit through BEM, which is semi-official.
Okay, so this
know if I want to...
BAM is Bristol Housing Action.
Yes.
So this is a group which helps people homeless to find some sort of accommodation.
Yes, yes.
How did you end up here in the UK?
Oh, I came the long way. Left home some 2 years ago, a little over. Went down to Rome, went over to Spain, then France, and came up here looking for a friendly, good place to live.
And how do you find Britain?
I like it very much.
Why?
Good people. Like not brain dead. Like the rest of the world.
How do you compare Eastern Europe with Western Europe and Britain?
I love them all. I love my country too, but I like it better here.
Well, tell us something about Hungary, you know, because many people in the UK have never been to many of these Eastern European countries. What's Hungary like? Is it warm?
Four seasons, very hot. We get 43 degrees Celsius regular some days or weeks lately. It gets very hot in the summer, and we get some snow. We get cold winter too.
Also, I suppose we could say Bristol's quite a multinational city. There's people from lots of different countries living here. That is a bonus. And I think for some people, they think, oh, there's too many people coming into Britain. But I think, you know, it's probably fair to say that there's more of a benefit from the migration of people into the country. Do you think you're going to stay here permanently in the UK? Would you like to stay?
I'm getting stuck.
All right, well, I'm also joined by Martin, who's originally from Ireland. How did you end up in Bristol, Martin?
Oh, I was stupid enough to be in love with a woman from Bristol and broke up for a bit, and I decided I'm still in love with her, so I came over to get her back. It worked out temporarily. Didn't work out the long run, but there's all kinds of things around that.
So what about similarities and differences between where you're from, as you said, somewhere in Ireland, and where we are here in Bristol?
I like Bristol. I like Bristol a lot because it does remind me of where I'm from in Ireland. I'm from Cork in Ireland, which is right down the south, if you imagine.
Straight south.
Yeah, south, it is literally right in the middle of the island. If you fold the map of Ireland in half, it's literally right in the middle. Like,
okay,
right,
so apart from your lady friend, what is it about Bristol that appeals to you?
Like I said, it reminds me of home, but it's not either, you know. It, like, Cork is like Bristol. It's a very multicultural, artistic place, you know, with a lot of tradition, you know, and a lot of, like, it's got a lot of spirit, it's got a lot of energy, you know, and it knows what it is and what it represents and what it doesn't represent, you know.
Yeah, it's quite a historical
and it's very
city.
Socially conscious.
As a historical maritime city, Bristol sort of for centuries has been having people from all over the world coming in here. Let's start with you though, Martin, talking a bit about the Bear Pit, because 2 years ago, it was quite thriving. It was an art space. There were people coming down doing specific managed artworks down there. Mm. And the toilets were open. Now, no art and no public toilets.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, ever since they shut down the toilets, and most people in Bristol will notice already that they shut down the toilets, and then people started to squat the toilets. Because there's a massive homeless community in Bristol, given that it's the number one city in the UK for homeless services. There is, like, as many people in the UK will know that most places, most towns, most even cities in the UK have either grossly underfunded homeless services or services around homelessness, or they're just non-existent. Bristol is one of the cities with a social consciousness that says we need this, you know, and we need to help people and take care
of
people.
Other people will say that drugs are cheap in Bristol, so a lot of people come to Bristol.
The reason drugs are cheap in Bristol is because a lot of people get sent to Bristol by other places around the UK to get their homelessness resolved. Now, whether that's literally being sent here because of various reasons, maybe they're from Bristol and there's this whole local connection thing going on. And a lot of people come here because they know that there's so many homeless services here. The Bear Pit, for the last, 20, 30 years, has been a space that attracts those people that are downtrodden and excluded.
Well, it's
and
a
oppressed.
Sort of a communications node, in a way, between Stokes Croft and the city centre.
Yeah.
The Bear Pit is where a lot of people... Now, the what about the... some people feel intimidated, that's what they say, including some of the traders that were down there, by having homeless people hanging around.
Their approach was wrong.
So right. What happened?
They came in. Like anybody would, starting up a business and with all the effort in the world and everything like that, focused on building their business, which is perfectly reasonable. I can understand that, right? It's nothing to be not expected. But what they did very quickly is they got sick of the homeless people down there asking them for things like food and water and stuff like that because, you know, they're homeless people. They're hungry, they're thirsty, they're this, they're that. You know, they need help. And those people there decided to not help them at all. In fact, to get angry at them and then to start putting out public information about these people,
well,
saying all kinds of
things. The traders would say, I'm sure that they did say this, is that the homeless would just come over, use our Wi-Fi in the cafe, but they wouldn't be buying anything.
Ah, well, god damn. Wi-Fi users who don't pay for Wi-Fi. Look, if you're going to have something that you're beaming out onto, into the open air, and you don't want people to have it, you better make damn well sure that it's in a cage as well, you know, so nobody can get at it.
And
the
John,
thing about Wi-Fi, is it's just internet access, and this could really help that. How do you know that that person using that Wi-Fi on that day
I suppose
didn't help them get somewhere to stay?
Some might say that the council should be providing that for free anyway. But, John, how do you see the relationship between the former traders that were in the Bear Pit and, you know, the homeless people and the people just walking through? I mean, some of them say, as I said to Martin, if they feel intimidated by homeless people being down there.
But I heard the boss, the people were calling the police because somebody had an open bottle of beer there and stuff like that. They were calling the police for everything that it has something to do with homeless people, I guess.
But there's both types, isn't there? There's also drug dealers, spice dealers have been down there, as well as homeless people. Is there any difference between the two? Is a sort of, you know, I suppose the idea is this is an open public space,
yes,
and it's for homeless, it's for people walking to and from work, and it's also for spice dealers.
What was the question?
Is it? I mean, is
any,
it
any difference between the homeless and the drug dealers? Well, there is a big difference.
I mean, is who is there any way, do you think, to make it a space just for genuine homeless people and to keep the drug dealers out? Is that feasible? Because that's obviously going to be better for the homeless who are down there.
Well, we are working on it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's risky business, so I don't really like talking about it because I don't like to be opposed to any group of people.
Yeah, it's a job for the police, really. I mean, it's not as if they're a million miles away, is it? I mean,
it's not my job. I am not a policeman.
What about the whole situation with the toilets? Were you around before the toilets were closed or not?
No, I'm here for 1 year. Just about now.
What do you think, is it feasible to get the toilets reopened, and would that make a difference?
Yes, of course. Well, I mean, what way? You know, it makes a big difference if you have to go to the toilet if it's open.
It's that would be convenient for everybody, not just homeless people. Like, I mean, you know, I'm sure you need to go to the toilet as well sometimes when you're passing through the Bear Pit. Wouldn't that be convenient?
I mean, particularly for elderly people out in the city centre.
Tourists.
And also, you can quite often get told no, you can't use the toilets with say, for instance, like if you want to use the pub toilets or something like that. But, I mean, the other big thing which has changed is that there is an active free shop, which takes place, I think it's on Thursdays, Fridays and Saturdays.
It's open Monday to Saturday these days now.
In the afternoon.
As of last week, I opened it up from Monday to Wednesday as well, as the Thursday, Friday, Saturday.
So, Martin, maybe you can tell us what the free shop is. What's the point of that?
The point of the free shop is to help people. And also teach charities a lesson in morality, because we run a free shop, which is a charity shop with absolutely no bias towards making a profit for anybody else, except for to profit people's lives who need help.
What sort of people come along to the free shop then?
Everybody.
Do you think some people come along who actually could pay for something, but they just want to take it for free?
Oh, we have plenty of people that come along. And you can spot them a mile away as well because of the way they dress, we'll say, you know? There's a vast difference between a stock trader on Wall Street and a homeless guy on Wall Street, and you can tell the difference. So we do. We get lots of homeless people. The number one demand we have for in the free shop is tea and coffee, you know? And a chat, really, you know? And again, it's another space for people to come and socialise and communicate. And there is no other space in Bristol that I know of that provides tea and coffee to the homeless during the day, over a period extended beyond an hour or two. And there's no other space in the city where homeless people know they can come and not be rejected because of some behaviour issue in the past.
Do you think the free shop changes the bear pit space at all? Is it a safer space, a more dangerous space, because the people are attracted to the free shop when it's open?
Safer space, because those people are coming to the bear pit. If you're a homeless person on, say, Broadmead, and you come to the bear pit looking for the free shop to get a cup of tea, and you come down there and there's no free shop, you have something you want and you can't get it. That's an annoyance. That can cause a agitation and therefore aggression, and aggression turns to anger, and anger turns to violence, right? Now, this is a problem with homeless people in general. Not a problem with them, but this is a situation that gets created over and over and over again.
I mean, it sounds to me like it's sort of sending out some quite good vibes, really.
Yeah, well, what my personal motivation is for, one, opening up from Monday to Wednesday as well, as the Thursday, Friday, Saturday, is one, lesson in morality. You either help people or you genuinely cannot. Everything else is just an excuse for you being a bad person, right? Secondly, is that these people live highly unstable lives, right? And I want the free shop to be a stable point in their lives that they can come to and know it's going to be there and know it's going to be open and know that they can get help no matter what that help is.
What's the purpose of the free shop then?
Providing clothes and coffee mostly.
And what sort of people need that?
Mostly homeless people or people who have not much money.
Students come.
Not just really elderly. Homeless. Mostly probably homeless people, just like poor people, students who have not much money.
Well, a lot of students say that they don't have enough money to go out. They just have enough money to pay the rent, basically. Then they get stuck and they get cabin fever staying in their student flats. So there's an excuse for them to come out and get something that they don't have to pay for. But what's it like to actually live there, John? Because this is the bottom line, isn't it? You're in a very public space there.
Yes, a crazy roller coaster. Really, very, it changes from minute. It gets really good. Sometimes you get really good atmosphere there, and then it gets really crazy. Just really absolute roller coaster.
I think most people would probably find it difficult dealing with that sort of chaos. How do you cope?
I don't know. Myself. And everybody tells me, I don't know how you do it.
What about you, Martin?
I'm Jesus, aren't I? You know, a lot of people listening to this, well, you got be long, like, wow, that guy is nuts.
But, long hair and a beard.
Long hair and a beard. and I'm a nice guy, so people are like, oh, that guy is Jesus, you know? But yeah, he's, like you said, it's a roller coaster.
What's it actually like to live down there day to day? I mean, ups and downs.
It's like living in a war zone. You're just waiting for the next thing to kick off, as opposed to things kicking off constantly. You're just like, you know, something's going to happen, and you're just waiting for it to happen. And some of it is nuts funny. Like, you see something nuts. Like, I saw it the other day. There was three spice heads smoking a spice joint, and then everybody knows a way to kind of, like, gouge out and stuff, and then, like, zombified. They were standing in a circle smoking this joint, and they all, at the same time, kind of put their heads together, and that were actually all leaning on each other, not deliberately, but they were spiced out and standing up.
Collapsing.
And it created a kind
collapsing
of...
Collapsing in unison,
much like the way a teepee does, because it's three poles makes a teepee, you know? And the fact that they're all falling down means they're all holding each other up as well.
Can you say something about spice? Because, you know, this is a relatively new drug on the streets, isn't it?
Oh, it's not. No. God, no. It's been around for what? Since 2000 and... No, actually, it was 1997, actually, it's been around since. A lot of people might know it as bath salts and things like that. Artificial weed. Head shops sold it for quite some time when it was quote-unquote legal.
And what sort of effect does it have? What is it?
It's an artificial marijuana substitute. That's what it was originally sold as. So the war on drugs led people to create drugs that were legal because they weren't defined under the illegal sense. It contains artificial THC, which has 10 times the strength of regular THC, which might sound great, but it's kind of like in the same way a 1 kilo weight, you know, being weed, and a 10 kilo weight falling on your head. What's the difference? Well, you know, one's going to knock you out, the other one is going to knock you out and probably kill you at the same time. You know, like, that's the difference between weed and spice anyway. And it's I personally believe, funny this coming from a guy who claims to be Jesus. I don't actually claim to be Jesus. Please don't worry, everybody. But, yeah, it's like, for ages people have been saying weed is the devil's lettuce. Well, if that's the devil's lettuce, then spice is the devil's oregano.
What are your thoughts about the drug issue, John? Is it feasible to, you know, criminalise, legalise? You know, any thoughts about that?
Drugs should be legal, really. Ed Kofi Annan said that.
This is the UN Secretary-General?
Yeah, yes, ex. And I think she's right. Or he. I'm sorry.
He is right. Why?
Because it creates all the bad things around drugs.
Well, like, you know, drugs don't destroy communities. The illegality of drugs destroy communities. There's no, like, 16, 17, 18, 19, however many year old, little black kiddies, white kiddies, Chinese kiddies, whatever they are, up in prison right now for selling weed, right? None of them are actually really bad people. Do you know what they were? Young entrepreneurs trying to create a job for themselves and make money for themselves. Instead, because the drug was illegal, they got sent to prison.
Also, bearing in mind that the jobs market is really difficult at the moment.
Oh, yeah.
People will jump at a chance, maybe, to do that and get into the illegal markets.
Yeah. But that's the thing. Like, the governments know that if you create a block for a legal route for something to happen, it will just bypass that route and go down the illegal route. This was proven during Prohibition in the States.
But I mean, this means surely that people would just go and buy spice in a shop. Children might do that.
But that's why they made it illegal, because it's so much worse than marijuana. That's why spice is a class A now, and I believe weed is a B or C. It's really been taken down there. In actual fact, I don't even know why it's classed as an illegal substance anymore.
I mean, if you're decriminalising drugs, those drugs might just be available over the... Well, they would. They'd be just over the counter.
Yeah.
How's that going to make things better and easier? I mean, lots of mums sending their kids to school don't want them spending their pocket money on drugs.
Well, if kids mom's elbows.
Drugs to kids,
yeah,
just because it's legal. Just like you don't sell alcohol and tobacco to kids
and firearms, you know. You don't sell flamethrowers to 5-year-olds, do you?
No. Yeah. Fair enough. Okay, so there can
and
be
there are
some
of
legal
legislation
restrictions on it, but it's sold legally in like certain places. Okay, also there's been this whole struggle with the city council, and they've now got an eviction order or a possession order on the Bear Pit. What do you think is going to happen now? What's the situation?
Hard to tell. Nothing.
Maybe. What's it like living down there, not knowing if you're going to be evicted or not? Because, like most people, you know, most people have got some kind of
guarantee
that they're going to be in the same house tomorrow, the next week, the next month.
The worst.
Not you.
Monday, Tuesday, this week, every morning we are waiting for the bailiffs to show up, kick the door on us, and I have... it's terrible. It's terrible.
Well, how do you go to sleep at night not knowing if you're going to be woken up violently?
You can imagine.
Martin?
How do I sleep at night, Widow? Oh, I smoke copious amounts of marijuana to deal with my stress. When I say copious amounts, as of late, since Friday, basically, since we lost in the court, I've been smoking more weed because the stress is up there. And I had a drink there the other week, which I'm supposed to be recovered, but nobody's ever recovered alcoholic. You know, and I ended up drinking a half a bottle of whiskey because of this.
So it puts more stress,
More stress. I mean, you know, think of it like this, right? We go to bed anyway with the fear of being woken up with violence, right? That's just the Bear Pit, right?
That's before the
yeah.
court case.
But you see, the thing is, those lads who will come in and commit violence on us, they'd only be looking to get a specific thing off of us and then take that away, and then we can just go back to bed. Yeah, still have our house, still have our home, right? But bailiffs come in, we're going to end up back on the streets, you know? Like, do you want us like to go from... Because it's taken me 6 months now, I've been living there, and I've gotten my headspace, my psychology... out of being a homeless person and into being somebody who's relatively securely housed and wants to get on and do stuff with his life now. And this is where I am now. So it took me about 4 or 5 months to like wrap my head around the fact that I was in a place that was mine and nobody was going to take it away and that I could stay here and sleep here. And then... Even though in the court, the council don't own it, we won the morality argument and we won the justice argument, right? So evidence, morality, justice, right? All three of those things, and even the judge said we won it, but still gave it over to the council. And now I've lost half a stone since, like, this time last week, the stress. Sleep eludes me unless, you know... I'm so drugged up. And people notice at home who deal with stress with alcohol. Like, you know, like alcohol, weed is chalk and cheese, like, isn't the thing. It's red cheddar cheese and yellow cheddar cheese. That's the difference between alcohol and weed right now, like, isn't a stress relief thing, like, you know? I don't know how to like, you know.
Have you got any idea deal with this in a healthy what way? The council... want you out for, what they intend to do with the place?
As far as I'm led to be aware, as of the council's own official plans, their plans are to take the bus and the containers out and the bear out.
And then what?
Oh, that was it. That's it. That's all they have plans for right now. And rename it, not the Bear Pit, the Circle. Which is 250 grand worth of originality to call a roundabout, a circle.
I was pissing out. What was the question?
Well, I'm just saying, what is the intention? Do we evict people and then what?
Well, it's hard to tell. They say they have a £3.5 million pound plan. But they say they have no money. So really, the plan is just to t- take the bear, take the bus, take the containers and the event space, point, and end of the story. And then we figure something out.
Yeah. Maybe it's going to be a rat, inner city rat, you know, what you call it, conservation area for inner city black and brown rats.
What about the event space you mentioned there? Have you had some events down at the Bear Pit whilst you've been living there?
Yes, several or almost regular. We have since almost the beginning of the year, and they all went down peacefully.
What sort of event? What music? What sort of thing?
We have live bands playing, punk bands, and DJs in other occasions, and everybody seemed to enjoy it very much and surprisingly peaceful. You know,
I mean, in a situation like that, you've got to have surely some kind of stewardship of it, you know, because I mean, there's lots and lots of time and effort goes in clubs and places like that where there's events into making sure that your audience is a safe space for them.
Yes.
How do you do that in somewhere like the Bear Pit?
I had just one time on the stage, I had to ask somebody to chill out, and it was only one occasion, but it didn't turn into a fight. And we didn't have to do anything, really. People just enjoying the music and forget about the aggression that usually comes up when people party.
it's almost like an amphitheatre, Martin, isn't it? It's a natural event space, I think, potentially.
No. Well, my whole plan is, if people would listen to me, my plan would be to just turn it into a communal event space. It's already what it is anyway. Like, you know, this isn't like some revelation that people are going to be listening to, but like...
Well, what do you make of the events that have already happened there? What's been going on?
Between the food that Johnny serves up, which is trying to do every day, because of a resource scarcity, we can't do every day. Between that and then the protests that we've had down there, which are the Extinction Rebellion and various other little protests going on, because it's so central and people can see it so easily, it's a very good space for people to get their message heard, you know. And then there's the music gigs. We've had live bands and we had DJs and MCs and rappers and stuff like that. We've had really big names down there that, to be honest with you, I can't remember because I'm not a massive fan of MCs and rappers and stuff. So like, I wouldn't be able to tell you. And there's a mate of mine who knows these people, as in is like, oh my God, that person played in the Bear Pit. I can't believe you got that person to play in the Bear Pit. Because they all want to play in the Bear Pit, you know? And we've had complaints from the hotels. We have had complaints from the hotels.
So what are you up till 2 or 3 in the morning?
No, we're about 12:30, which is less than the nightclubs that have bigger sound systems than us. And actually, literally, like, even though I am, 2/3 of a mile away from Blue Mountain in the Bear Pit, right? It still vibrates my entire 5 tons of steel container, yeah? Right? It still vibrates that like it's right next to the thing. So I don't know what they're complaining about noise from us. But the other thing is we've had complaints from the hotels and only the hotels and managers and stuff like that. But we haven't had any complaints from the people who stay in the hotels. In fact, the exact opposite.
Well, you'll probably find the people in the rooms are phoning reception saying, can you do something about this noise?
No. We had one guy come down in his underpants and say, oh my God, I can't believe I got a rave, a hotel room and a mad night for 68 quid because I stayed in the Premier Inn on this night. We had a man and his wife and his 3 kids come down, you know, in the robes and stuff from the hotel. You know, we've had tourists from the Holiday Inn, and there's Premier Inn, and there's the Hampton, and then there's the student accommodation up behind us, and then there's various residences in front of us going up Soaks Cross and stuff, and everybody seems to like it. There was a period where, because of a bit of like almost anarchistic kind of like, we're going to play music 24/7 initially with people, you know, to really show people that were in the bear pit, right? There was a few complaints from people in apartments and stuff who would work the next day about music going on until 3, 4, 5 in the morning. So that's when we cut it down to 12:30.
John, what would you say to people, to wrap up, what would you say to people who feel on their way to work or their way home from work, they're intimidated to go through the bear pit?
I don't know what to say.
Martin?
I would say don't be intimidated by people who desperately need and want your help, you know? Don't be intimidated by people who, at the end of the day, are more afraid of you than you are of them, because you only have to call the police on them and they can be doing nothing and you can say, that homeless person is bugging me, and they'll get arrested and taken away, you know? I can't even sit on the side of the street sometimes without the police being called.
I'm just, what's occurring to me, John, is that there's an aspect here where there's something about homelessness which disturbs people.
Yes, it's really just being scared for no reason, I think. I mean, homeless people don't attack others just walking by, you know?
It's maybe as someone walking past is looking at a homeless person, they're scared for themselves, maybe, that they don't want to end up like this?
Yes, more likely, because it's something you don't know, you know, what it's like being a homeless. And people are afraid in general of things that they don't know, I think.
Yeah. And Martin, I mean, you understand why people might feel...
Oh, yeah, I understand.
...annoyed, frustrated, you know, and when they look at somebody who's a homeless person, feel afraid of being in that situation?
Oh, yeah, God, yeah. I was. And then I became homeless, and no, I'm not. Because I know at the end of the day, and here's the thing, homeless people, if you just take the first little bit away from that title, still just people like you and me and everybody else, they're people. Just go up to them and have a chat with them, you know? And if they're asking you for something constantly, well, maybe it's because they really, really need your help, or, you know, they could use a hand. And maybe you might not be able to help them. But remember, nobody asks for something unless they need it.
Well, Martin and John from the Bear Pit, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. Local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My second book, which is the wildcard book, is this one. It's entitled OPJB, which is short for Operation James Bond, The Last Great Secret of the Second World War. Well, it's a big claim to make, isn't it? The author, Christopher Crichton, isn't actually the name of the chap that really wrote it, because he was worried about the Official Secrets Act. I mean, you know, when you see something like that on the shelf, you must think to yourself, oh yeah, right, you know. And I did when I first saw it, but I was persuaded to read it by a woman who was vaguely connected with the book. History is written by the winners, they say, don't they? Winston Churchill really did even better, didn't he? He said, history will be kind to me, I know, because I shall write it. And this is a really good example, OPJB, of the, they never tell you what you really need to know. So having read it, I'm absolutely 99% have a little bit of scepticism, but 99% sure that's true. I mean, I've met, for example, people who knew the author. I wanted to get to know the author, because he died about 4 years ago. And what kind of character was he? There was also a chap called Manfred Seligman, who was a reviewer for the Daily, oh gosh, Evening Standard. And he devoted a whole chapter in his memoirs, I think it's Hitler, Marilyn and Me, terrific book, and a whole chapter of that into him helping him get this published, because it was an absolute nightmare to get it published. There's all sorts of problems with it. He had death threats, for example. Manfred, just for helping him, had death threats. And it's interesting, isn't it, how since this was published, there's been a whole load of spoilers come out about the sort of end game of World War II, which say that Hitler survived the war, blah, blah. well, poppycock, total rubbish. And in fact, they're there to divert people into the wrong direction, because this has got some fascinating stuff about what really happened. And the end game of the war was all about the Nazi gold, wasn't it? I mean, the loot that the Nazis had taken from all the capital cities of Europe, where did it go? Well, he makes a big effort in explaining it here. And he describes in this book an operation which he was the operational commander of. Ian Fleming was his boss, to capture Hitler's secretary, Martin Bormann, from Berlin, right from under the noses of the Russians, right at the end of the war, and to bring them by boat, by canals, and all the people who were doing the operation were trained commandos. I mean, the Nazis totally feared the British commandos because they were extremely ruthless. They kill silently, etc., and they were all trained to use canoes. So Bormann was brought out right the last days of the war, all the way out. But the thing is, of course, as you know, the Russians occupied all that part of the country, so they had to be very, very daring to sort of bring this little British unit under the noses of the Russians. Official Secrets Act, so that's why you had to use a pseudonym. You know, it's very similar to some of the other best books out there. Well, it's the opposite in a way, because Wheatley also worked in World War II secretly in Whitehall. And he and Ian Fleming had both done a lot of really secret stuff in the war, which no one was ever supposed to know about afterwards. And they realised that they couldn't. And in fact, for Fleming, he became an alcoholic after the war, and it was only when he started writing that he got over the alcoholism. He realised, this is what I need to do, because he was troubled by all the stuff that had happened, and he knew that he could get it out through fictional novels. Wheatley did exactly the same. Christopher Crichton, John Ainsworth Davis, was absolutely determined to write it as a factual account, and of course that's why it took so much longer to come out. So John Ainsworth Davis, I'll just refer to him as JAD, easiest quick way, which a lot of people do, was a teenager at Chartwell. He was groomed, basically, by a guy called Desmond Morton, who lived in that area of Westerham before Churchill had even moved in. So one wonders whether Churchill bought Chartwell to be near Desmond Morton. So the other thing about JAD was that his father was close friends of von Ribbentrop before the war, who then became the Nazi foreign minister. And so he was a perfect potential spy to send in. Oh, yeah, Ribbentrop's friend, yeah. So they were operating under something called M-Section of MI6. Now, the interesting thing about M-Section was it wasn't funded by the Ministry of Defence. It wasn't funded by us. Guess who funded it? King George VI directly funded this little unit. And who was Desmond Morton? A very powerful figure in the war, in the Second World War. He was the private secretary to Winston Churchill. And he was, before that, he'd been head of interwar political and economic warfare, based in Bedfordshire and various other places. But, I mean, you know, he was somebody who was very, very close to these wars and a very unknown character, fascinating to look into. And Jill Bennett, who's the former, I interviewed a few years ago, she was the former head librarian at the Foreign Office. And she, when she retired, decided, Morton is a really, really interesting character. No one's ever written a book about him. I'm going to do it. And she called it something like Winston Churchill's Secret, something, I can't remember the title, but it's a fantastic little book. So they made sure these people, there was no paperwork trail. So don't bother going down the public records office looking for this. They spent a lot of their time, actually, when some disaster happened, going around and finding all the paperwork and destroying it. That was actually what they spent probably two-thirds of their time doing at M-Section. It's just making sure that there was no evidence going to be left to history about some horrendous disaster. Two of those disasters he describes in here. One is in August 1942, the Dieppe attack, which was a complete disaster. Basically, the Dieppe attack was there. They did that because Stalin was getting very angry that the Western Front hadn't been opened in 42, after Russia was the only, they were the only people, the Soviet Union was the only people fighting the Nazis. And we were just sitting there sort of, making tea and getting prepared or whatever for years and years. We didn't do anything. So Dieppe happened. And it was a total disaster. 4,000, mostly Canadian, soldiers were killed. Now, he explains in this book that the reason it was such a disaster was him. He was sent into Nazi Germany to warn the Germans that they were coming. And he was stood, apparently, with one of the German generals on the clifftop as the invasion came. And they'd held a pistol to his head and said, if this invasion doesn't come, you're getting a bullet in the head. And, of course, the invasion did come, and he was then more trusted by the Nazis. So these games that this M section were playing were pretty horrendous and led to the death of 4,000 people and a complete disaster then. A bit later in the war, he describes the Slapton Sands cover-up, which was just before D-Day. 420 US soldiers were killed there. The whole thing was entirely covered up. And it was M section's job to make sure there was no paperwork trail. What had happened when they were doing an exercise in the channel and they were attacked by a bunch of German E-boats. And loads of these people who were on this exercise were killed. And it was basically because they hadn't bothered to put any Royal Navy protection onto the exercise. And so they had to cover the whole thing up. The book describes a place called Burdham, which is a secret training establishment, now we know, near Chichester. And they were using the old Chichester Canal for the training to get, you know, to get Bormann out of Berlin. Many people say Bormann died. Well, I mean, having read this and having looked at the evidence and spoken to some of the people, I just simply don't believe that at all. He survived. He was brought out of, by the British. One of the weird twists to this is that I got to meet a woman called Jill Golding, who lives on Hayling Island, runs a bed and breakfast. And her grandfather, Harold Wilkinson Golding, DSO, when her grandmother died, she discovered an old suitcase in the loft. Because her grandfather had always been a mystery to her. Where did he get his DSO? What did he do in the war? Because he mysteriously died 6 weeks after the end of World War II. And it was always a mystery in the family. Nobody knew. And her grandmother wouldn't say anything. As many people die keeping these secrets, actually. Right to this day, people are dying, saying, well, no, that was secret in the war. It's secret now. I'm going to die with that secret. He was aged about 40, mysteriously died. Anyway, it turns out that he was the no less than the commander at UK Coastal Forces in the Second World War, somewhere called HMS Northerney based, which is now Hayling Island. And the interesting thing about him was that it was his troops that were used for this secret operation. So the implication is that he was not happy. He had been spun a lie about the way they were going to be used. And when he found out that they'd been used to bring a top Nazi out of Berlin, so that Nazi could do deals with the Allies, he was raging, livid. And so he didn't last very long. He was sent to some hospital and died. So that's the sort of... that's what's in here. And it's been a privilege over the years to meet some of these people who actually knew John Ainsworth Davies as a man of absolutely immense character and integrity, who has lived with this secret for most of his life, tried very hard to get it out, and it was published in 1996, finally. And, I mean, he must have known that maybe people wouldn't believe him. In a lot of the reviews, you'll find, oh, what a load of rubbish, it's all just made up. Well, you have to make your own mind up if you ever read it. So I'll do a little extract from it now, which is, I mean, one of the most unbelievable things is, how do you bring a flotilla of commandos by river out into the British zone, or whatever, the American zone or whatever, out of Russian-occupied Germany in the last days of the Second World War. Not an easy thing to do. And they're paddling along the Havel River now. As the Havel narrowed, once again becoming more river than lake, the current picked up and we coasted with it, paddling only enough to steer and hold station. Then at last we swept around a bend and saw the bridge ahead. It was dark. No lights shone down onto the water. We were still 400 or 500 yards off when Susan signalled to the whole flotilla, hoist battle ensigns. Every other kayak had a bamboo pole or wireless aerial specially prepared for this moment, and now within a minute the Soviet red naval ensign, together with its miniature hammer and sickle, had been hoisted up above our boats. The river became quite narrow and it offered nowhere to hide. We all had Thompson submachine guns ready on our laps and grenades to hand. But only in the last resort did we mean to use violence. Watching from my own kayak, third in the line, I waited till I judged the moment right and sent out the orders with my RG lamp. Alice away. Brabenov flashed back. Alice, affirmative. As she swung her canoe in towards the starboard bank, her crewman, Sergeant John Rawlins, fired his fairy pistol. A red and white flare arched up over the bridge, and within seconds the Russians responded. Searchlights blazed on, flooding the surface of the river and catching us full in their glare. In a few moments, Brabenov had reached the bank, jumped ashore and called out in Russian through a loud hailer. Rebyata, she roared. Lads, send down your senior officer to meet me.
Her voice was harsh, her manner all arrogance and aggression. As she waited on the bank in her usual stance, feet apart, hands on hips, she radiated the impression that anyone who displeased her would find themselves in dire trouble. When a Soviet captain came forward, she announced herself as Comrade Colonel Natasha Andreevna Sarova and told the man she was leading an NKVD patrol on search of escaping Nazi criminals. Further, she was acting on the personal authority of Marshal Zhukov, the Soviet Supreme Commander. To prove what she said, she brought out identity cards and pass, which had apparently been signed by Zhukov. Before the captain could ask her anything, she let loose a torrent of questions about the state of the river downstream and the disposition of any German forces still offering resistance. Hardly giving him a chance to answer, she then bombarded him with a volley of orders. What a cheek of them, honestly. He was then to let other Soviet units downstream know she was coming. He was to make sure they all had relevant information ready for her. He was to stand by the following night to help her escort through the bridge, the second half of her own party, who consisted of 2 motorboats and 10 more kayaks. Finally, he was to keep his eyes skinned for Nazi war criminals. If he found any and arrested them, he would be sure of immediate promotion. With that and a curt carry-on, she jumped back into her own canoe. In unison, she and her crewmen flicked their kayak round. The glare of the searchlights picked up the little Soviet red ensign, which fluttered cheekily from the tip of her radio aerial. Still fully in character, she waved her arms like a Russian cavalry officer ordering the charge and shouted at us, "Nu popli, dashe! Paddle on! And davite, davite, she! Shift yourselves!" So that's just one encounter with the Russians as they were on their way out, and not all of them go quite so well. So that's OpJB, The Last Great Secret of the Second World War, a.k.a. Christopher Crichton, really written by John Ainsworth Davis.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast, if you like, at dialectradio.oneword.co.uk. Thanks to Martin Cosgrave with his tune, I Tried to Write a Song, which was done in 2002. Also to John and another Martin, Bear Pit residents, evicted by the mayor, Marvin Rees, because of spice dealers. And lastly, thanks to Tony Gosling on Christopher Crichton's book. And to studio engineers Dave Pozanko and Joss Chivers. Dialect is a Bristol Broadband co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. And anyone can contribute. You can contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. If you have some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect. I'm Annabelle Provençal, wishing you a very good week. Tony Gosling will be back on Friday with his 2-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 to 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
Nights in white satin, never reaching the end. Letters I've written, never meaning to send. Beauty I'd always missed with these eyes before. Just what the truth is, I can't say anymore, 'cause I love you. some hand in hand. Just what I'm going through, they can understand. Some try to tell me thoughts they cannot defend. Just what you want to be, you will be in the end. And I love you. Letters are